Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, and Google have all made statements against NSA surveillance. Executives there say they will not release personal information to the NSA without informing users first. This is the latest development in a wave of backlash against government surveillance. The wave was set in motion almost a year ago when Edward Snowden leaked documents revealing the full extent of government surveillance. It also cracked open a conversation about privacy, spying, and information gathering. In her new book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance, award-winning journalist Julia Angwin writes, quote, "Any of us can be watched at almost any time, whether it's by a Google Street View car taking a picture of our house, or an advertiser following us as we browse the web, or the NSA logging our phone calls," end quote. Julia Angwin tried to avoid being monitored during everyday activities such as reading and shopping. She tried to obscure her location. She used encryption when communicating with friends, and she put her cell phone in a cage bag to avoid being tracked. But it did not work. She could not escape the trackers. So how can we remain private, if possible, online? Joining us to talk about her efforts, privacy, surveillance, and internet freedom is Julia Angwin, an award-winning investigative journalist at the independent news organization ProPublica. From 2000 to 2013, she was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, where she led a privacy investigative team that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in explanatory reporting in 2011. Her new book is called Dragnet Nation. Hi, Julia. Welcome back to the show. Hi, Julia. Are we having problems getting Julia? All right, we're going to reconnect with Julia. If you'd like to join us, we had Julia on about a couple months ago, and we wanted to bring her back because we got so many phone calls from all of you asking her questions about how to remain private and how to use the internet anonymously. So we'd love to hear from you. If you've got any tips for users, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. When Julia was on the show, she talked about browsing anonymously, and then also she put her cell phone in this bag to prevent her cell phone from being tracked. And there's a new story, actually, that's making its way on Facebook about how the iPhone can track where you've been. And I checked this out yesterday, and it has a 95% accurate list of the places that you have visited. And we will talk with Julia about that, and we'll also let you know how you can disable that. And I believe we have Julia. Julia, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, nice to have you. Sorry about that.
It's so great to be here.
It's great to have you. So I wanted to ask you before we dive in and talk about privacy and some things that you've learned since you've been on our show a couple months ago. Net neutrality is making headlines right now, and I wanted to read a lead from the website Gotta Be Mobile. It says, for those concerned about the ongoing battle over net neutrality, this is a big week ahead. At the moment, the FCC is going forward tomorrow with a vote on the new rules that will decide the future of how the internet works. The decision to go forward with the vote instead of delaying it comes after at least two FCC commissioners have asked Chairman Tom Wheeler to postpone the action. There have been a lot of people flooding the FCC on Twitter, saying that this is a bad idea, do not go forward. Earlier this week, a coalition of over 100 major companies, including Amazon, Google, Facebook, declared their support for net neutrality. And even venture capitalists are saying, quote, if established, companies are able to pay for better access speeds or lower latency. The internet will no longer be a level playing field. So it's interesting to see what's happening right now. What are your thoughts on this net neutrality fight?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Net neutrality is sort of part of this overall issue that privacy also falls under, which is essentially the internet is this incredibly great decentralized network, but it's also a really great way to discriminate in the sense that as companies get a sense of who's on the other end of the line, you know, when you're checking a website, for instance, my Google search results will look different than yours because Google knows where I am, they know where you are, they know our preferences. And so essentially, that's the same kind of thing that's happening with net neutrality, which is that the people who provide this backbone connections are also like, you know what, we don't have to give the same internet to everybody. And the big companies are complaining because it might hurt them. You know, they're not as complaining as much when it comes to our privacy, but it's all kind of the same issue, which is unless we kind of rein in the capabilities, this decentralized network is obviously a really great network. I love the internet, but it also can be used to basically redline.
How did we get to this point? Because, I mean, I was on the internet in its infancy back in 95, and everybody at that point was talking about how this is the latest and greatest tool to democratize information and to be sure that everyone has access. And, of course, not everyone still has access, but how did we get to a point where if you pay, if like Comcast, for example, pays more than another ISP, like say a local ISP, you would be able to get information faster than the person who subscribes to the local ISP. How did we get to that point?
Well, we got here because, you know, we decided back, actually I think it was 95, 96, right around the time when you joined the internet, the Clinton administration said, you know, look, we are not going to regulate the internet. It's too new. It's really, it needs to be like free and unfettered. And there was a decision that lasted for about 10 years in Washington, which was like, don't touch the internet. Just let it kind of flower and blossom. And so we had a regulatory posture that was just like, let a thousand flowers bloom. And in fact, a thousand flowers did bloom, right? I mean, I think we could all say our lives have been enriched by incredible access to information. And a lot of that had been empowered by sort of the amazing innovations that have happened. But now we're in this era of just awakening to the fact that, like, not every innovation is super wonderful or super consumer friendly, or some of them have, you know, implications for redlining and that poor communities are going to be served less well. You know, right now there's this experiment in Texas where AT&T is offering fiber to the home, and you'll get the incredible speeds. But if you want, but they also want to read all your internet traffic. They actually want to look inside and see what you're saying for advertising purposes. And if you don't agree to that, you have to pay an extra $70 a month. Hmm. And so, you know, we're coming to this part where we're like, okay, we might be hitting up against the limits of sort of the free, unfettered internet, and it might be time to draw some lines about what we consider appropriate behavior.
Well, and you have sites like the BBC. They have an article today called Net Neutrality, Should You Care About It? And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people still don't understand how this works. And I think they did a good job of really putting this in perspective. The BBC story says those in favor of net neutrality argue that the internet service providers that provide the pipes for the content should just run the networks and have no say over how and what content flows to consumers as long as it's legal. But ISPs, internet service providers, argue that a tiered internet where those content providers prepared to pay can go in an internet fast lane is inevitable in today's data-hungry net world. So if you've got the money, you'll be able to send information to people faster. And if you don't, you're going to get left behind.
Right. I mean, it's basically like TSA pre-check, right? I mean, it's already just dividing us into these lanes, right? Which is like, you know, some people get to cruise through airport security because they've paid to do the TSA pre-check or whatever for global entry. And the rest of us are the schmoes in the slow lane. And I feel like the internet is also definitely going, you know, could well end up in that kind of situation.
How would this also affect writers and artists and, well, even maybe nonprofit news organizations like ProPublica? Astra Taylor focuses on these issues. She's got a book called The People's Platform, Taking Back the Power. And she wrote a piece for Bill Moyers saying that many of the writers, musicians, and artists she knows are vaguely aware that this is happening, but they really need to pay attention to this because it's really going to affect them the most.
Right, and that's always the case, right? I mean, the people who are affected by these kinds of changes, the people who are disadvantaged are usually the poorer, struggling artists or just people without financial resources. And then that means necessarily that they don't have as large a voice in Washington because the lobbying process is driven by money. Mm. And so it's been unfortunate. And that's what's really sad about the current era right now, which is that Washington is actually trying to take seriously the idea of regulating the internet in a way that hasn't happened before. But the only voices really at those tables in the serious negotiations end up being, you know, big companies with big financial resources.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Which companies at the moment in this field have the most power in Washington, D.C.? And what changes have you seen over the years?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, you know, Facebook's and Google's, like those internet companies didn't actually have very big Washington presences. They still believed that, you know, that Washington wasn't going to regulate them and that you know, they didn't have to worry about it. But they've really staffed up in the past 5 years. But that said, they're no match for the telecoms, you know, AT&T, Verizon. Those guys are in heavily regulated industries, and they've always been huge financial powerhouses in Washington, D.C. And so they still have a lot of power. I mean, it was amazing to me when President Obama said he wanted to reform the NSA surveillance in a way that by having the telephone companies store the data instead of the NSA. And the telephone company said no, and so he just retracted it. You know, it was like, okay.
How much influence do you think they have in D.C. right now? President Obama was recently in Silicon Valley, you know, one of these $32,000 a head fundraisers, and the Chronicle had an interesting article saying that he's now meeting with these very young, very incredibly wealthy Silicon Valley CEOs. They said something like, you know, at a party, if you're over 40, you're now too old, because so many of these guys, and they're mostly guys, are really young. So at a time when Silicon Valley is trying to get more power in D.C., are you seeing many changes at this point, or do you think we might have to wait and see in the coming years because it's just starting up?
It's hard to say how it's going to evolve, you know. And the truth is, I'm not sure it will be bad, right? I mean, in some sense, the people who started these internet companies tend to be, you know, they're, you know, like the founders of Google. You know, we're not evil, right? And I think that they, in general, are kind of really smart people who have really great ideas about how increased data can improve our lives and how technology can improve our lives. And I think they are even idealistic. And so some of those values might be great in Washington. I think it really depends, though, on how it all plays out, because some of those ideas also have huge impact on our society. You know, I'm not particularly sure I'm really in love with this idea of everyone walking around with these Google Glass glasses filming each other, right? So not every one of these future ideas is one that I think we're all bought into.
Julia Angwin is author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. She tried to avoid being monitored during everyday activities such as reading and shopping, but it was incredibly difficult to escape the trackers. And if you have any questions or comments for Julia about online privacy, with so much information coming out about the NSA and surveillance, how has it really changed the way you use the internet? I mentioned earlier that there's an article going around about how if you use an iPhone, without you knowing it, it stores where you've been. And I just checked this yesterday, Julia, and my iPhone has a 95% accurate list of places that I visited over the past month. And I didn't use maps. I didn't check in. I didn't tag. Like, I didn't go on Facebook and say, hey, I'm in Mendocino this weekend. So it's so interesting that all this information is now coming out. But the thing that I don't like is that we're automatically opted into these things.
Yeah,
so right. We have to go in and change the settings to say, okay, stop keeping a list of all the places that I've been over the last month.
Yeah, you know, I found that places list on my phone just a few weeks ago, too, and I was really mad because, you know, it's one of those things where every time you update your software, it's as if you they've forgotten all your preferences, and you have to go in and recheck every single thing, and this particular setting was buried, as I'm sure you found, in multiple layers of menus. And I'm pretty religious about this stuff, and I hadn't found it on the latest update. And I think that's really one of the things that really bothers me about our personal data economy right now, which is that there's a myth out there that you have choice, that you have chosen to give up your privacy, and that we all should just get over it because we're getting all these free services as a result. And so and we've made this decision freely. It's a free market. You know, calm down. And as I learned in my experiment, when I did try to opt out, when I tried to remove myself from that equation, where I said, you know what, I won't take the free service. I'll pay for a service that protects my privacy. Oftentimes, there was no alternative, right? Particularly on the phone, actually. There's no real privacy-protecting phone that you can get out there. There's a new one coming out that isn't out yet called the Black Phone, which is going to be theoretically privacy protecting, but it's $630 a phone.
Wow.
So, you know, that's a lot of money.
Well, that's what the iPhone costs these days.
Yeah, right.
Right?
But this, at least you can get the subsidy with the telephone service. But yeah, and so, you know, it's not always a viable choice to opt out. You know, I tried to opt out, for instance, of all these data brokers that sell your name and address. If you've ever Googled yourself, I'm sure you haven't. You know, nobody ever Googles their name. You might see those people show up. They're like, buy, you know, her address for $1.95. So I tried to opt out of all those guys. It turns out they don't have to offer opt-outs. It's there's no law requiring them to. So of the 212 sites like that I identified, only about 90 offered opt-outs, and many of them were too cumbersome, despite my best efforts, that I wasn't really able to opt out of them.
You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Today we're talking about efforts to remain private online or keep some kind of information to yourself. I mean, without you even knowing it, your phone can keep a list of all of the places that you have visited over the last month. And it's specific in terms of address. It's kind of amazing. And it's hard to keep up with this information because if you update your phone, it could get rid of all of your older privacy settings. So what questions do you have? And if you have any specific tips to share with us, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're speaking with Julia Angwin about her new book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. And let's hear from Catherine in Santa Cruz. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the show. Hi, is Catherine with us? Sorry about that, Catherine. You can give us a call back. I've got an email from Andy. He says, what search engine do you recommend that won't track us? You mentioned a site last time, but he didn't catch the URL.
I've been using a site called DuckDuckGo. It's D-U-C-K, like a quacking duck. So two ducks and then go, duckduckgo.com. And the reason I use them is that they don't store any data. So when I looked at my Google search results, it turns out, you know, they store them for years and years. Mine were stored dating back to 2006. And if you ask them not to store it, they will just store it by your IP address, which is actually can be just as revealing. It's the location from which you conducted your searches. And in my case, if you look up my IP address, it perfectly locates me in my home. And so I just didn't want there to be a record out there of all my searches. So I chose one that kept no logs. So I used DuckDuckGo. There's also one called iXQuick, I-X-Q-U-I-C-K, that is based in Europe and is also a good privacy-protecting search engine. I have been using services inside the U.S. because I find that, actually, weirdly, the NSA, as soon as your data leaves the U.S., they feel perfectly happy to hoover it up with no limits, whereas at least in the United States, they have to sort of defend why they're collecting domestic data. So I tend to use U.S.-based services for that reason.
What other tools did you find, I mean, in your research? And, you know, in terms of DuckDuckGo, that's really easy. What other easy tools did you find?
I know.
Right? Because I don't think a lot of people want to start using encryption or learn how that works. I mean, some of the stuff, you just, how many, you know, how much time does it take to do all of this? But let's go over the easy stuff first, and then if we can talk about encryption later.
Right. Although I would say there is one way to do encryption that's fairly easy, which is to put these encryption apps on your phone.
Oh,
so
okay.
There actually are apps for the iPhone. There's something called Silent Circle. And for the Android phone, there's Whisper Systems. It's called Red Phone or Text Secure. And those are actually encryption apps that if you and another person each have the same app, you can essentially just trade encrypted messages with that person. And that is actually a super easy way to do encryption. Now, of course, you have to convince all these other people to install an app, but that's not as big an ask as some of the other encryption software.
So does that mean that your text, for example, will be private?
Yes. So that is a great thing about it, is that your text messages in particular would be encrypted. And so obviously if somebody got control of your phone, grabbed it physically and knew your password and got into that app, they could find the record of it. But otherwise, it's not stored on some server somewhere, you know, where it could be seen, you know, for instance, with Google chat messages. You know, you've searched in your Gmail and seen that the chats are stored right there. And that's mostly true for most text messages, is that your cell phone carrier gets a copy of them, and your provider, Apple or Google, may get a copy of them. And so in those cases, your texts are kind of all over the place, whereas in these apps, they're encrypted and not stored.
And do we know how long these companies have our text message files?
You know, that is a very good question. It really ranges. So some telecom providers say that they only store text messages for 30 days or so at their services, but then others don't disclose, so we don't really know. And we do know that the NSA and GCHQ, actually, from the Snowden documents, had done a very aggressive attempt to capture, I think it was every text message in Europe at one point. And so we definitely know it's a high-value target.
Well, we'll definitely put all of this information on the website after the show. So thank you for the email. Let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Hi. This might seem terribly obvious because we get offers all the time for privacy. Get results with us. We can give you a cleaner computer. We can show you how to remove the viruses. We can get the malware out of your system. All those offers are being commercially promoted. But where is the offer that says we can get these tracers who are shadowing you, or the malware that they injected into your computer, into your network, we can get those out? Is anybody offering any kind of a service like that?
Julia, anyone offering that?
You know, that is a very good question, and it's one I get all the time. And the sad truth of it is there's not a really good way to find out what kind of malware has been installed on your computer. Much of it is designed to be invisible and requires incredible expertise to locate. And so there's one group in Toronto, the Citizen Lab. It's a group of computer science researchers that has really worked on this topic in particular. And so they, for instance, have found, like, they will analyze computers and phones from journalists. I think the most recent one they did was journalists in Ethiopia. And they found there was surveillance spyware installed on their machines. But these kind of projects that they do are months and months of forensics. And there are a lot of people who have asked me, is there a way to kind of do it just for my own machine? And I have not yet found, like, sort of a more consumer version of that.
Which company would you say does the least amount of information gathering?
Oh, gosh, the least?
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, we use these with Google, Facebook, you name it, Amazon. People just use these services on a regular basis. And I just wonder which one gathers the least amount of information. Do you know?
I mean, they're mostly in an arms race to gather the most amount of information. Like, so, you know, Google and Facebook are in this kind of insane land grab race where not only do they want to track you on their sites, but, you know, you've seen that Facebook has those little buttons, like buttons, all around the web. Those things can track when you arrive on that page. Google has tracking on almost every page on the internet, actually. And so they can see you across the board. And then, in addition, both of them buy data from offline data brokers to add to their files.
Wow.
So, you know, as far as I can tell, the race is entirely the other way, unless you want to talk about sort of the privacy protecting services that I use, which there are like five, right? And I can tell you all their names, but it's a very small market.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely talk about that after the break, and I'd love to know more about this offline information gathering sharing with online services. Julia Angwin is author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. She tried to remain private. She tried to avoid being monitored, and it was incredibly difficult. And we'll find out what services she uses to stay private after this. KALW.org.
800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org. Matt Martin here with Allie Budner, producer of Your Call. And your support right now will not only keep us strong, and we have this Dragnet Nation book by Julia Angwin, yours for a $120 contribution. It'll also help us toward our challenge for this hour. Two generous listeners, Kevin Persklove in San Francisco and another generous listener in Oakland, have put forward $865. They said if 20 people call or click 800-525-9917 during today's Your Call, they will give us that additional $865 of support.
And we will not share your personal information. If
we
you
never
call
do.
Or click online and donate, 1-800-525-9917 and get a copy of Julia Angwin's book for a $120 pledge. Please just join the public radio party. Say that you belong. Say that this matters to you.
And we are having an actual party on June 11th. Rose will be there. Allie will be there. I'll be there. Joe Burke. Everybody else in the KALW family. Everyone who contributes anything during these last hours of our campaign. And it's wrapping up tomorrow at 6 p.m. Your support keeps us strong. We're happy to have you there. 800-525-9917.
If you value that we've followed these questions of online privacy and net neutrality here on Your Call, please go ahead and give us a call, 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. And thanks.
Now, let's go back to Rose and Julia Angwin.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will be joined by Michael Lewis. We'll talk about his fascinating book, Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt. It's about a small group of men on Wall Street who figure out that the stock market has been rigged for the benefit of insiders, and that post-financial crisis, the markets have become not more free, but less and more controlled by the big banks. It's a fascinating read. You'll definitely want to tune in tomorrow. And then on Friday, we'll be joined by Anand Gopal. He'll be talking about his new book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about how to maintain some sort of privacy online with Julia Angwin. She is out with a new book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. She used encryption when communicating with friends. She put her cell phone in a Faraday cage, and I'll ask her more about that later, to avoid being tracked. She tried to avoid being monitored, and it was really hard. She could not escape the trackers. So if you have any questions about Julia's findings, or if you want to know anything about privacy online, privacy when you use your phone, if you have any tips for us about how to remain somewhat private, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Julia is an award-winning investigative journalist at ProPublica from 2000 to 2013. She was a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. So before the break, Julia, you said that online companies are also relying on the offline companies that gather our information. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, you know, what's happening is that despite all this online tracking, the companies that do online tracking seem to feel that they need more data. So there's been this huge effort to basically merge online data with offline data. So there are these companies offline who basically have been in the business in the past of selling mailing lists, right? Your name, your address. And they sold them to, you know, all those people who sent you junk mail. And now they've gotten they have all this data about people that they've collected for those purposes. And now they've realized there's this whole new market they can sell to, which is the online companies that want to figure out, you know, for instance, Facebook. It knows a lot about you online, but it also knows, interestingly, that what you present on Facebook is not always the entire picture of you, right? So, for instance, you know, all my posts might be really happy and show I'm really successful, but, you know, there's also more information out there about me. So they have been buying data from a company called Datalogix, which is like an offline broker that tracks offline information, your name, your address, your purchasing habits, all those kinds of things. And then they've been merging those files together to get a better picture of who their members are.
And then also talk a little bit about the five different privacy packages that you use. And why do you have to use five? Is it because there's no one place that provides everything that you would like?
Oh gosh, yeah. I think I might have just said five. I probably use more than a dozen, but I use a lot of different privacy tools, and essentially, they're not really all from one place. For instance, I wanted a privacy protecting email service. Gmail, you know, they actually, you know, their business model is to scan the contents of your email and then sell advertisements against that information. So, in essence, they're in the business of reading your email. That's not something I wanted to sign up for. I couldn't find, though, a real commercial alternative, so I found a small startup in Seattle called RiseUp.net that offers encrypted email with a little bit of storage. They don't store a lot of data on their servers because they feel like that's a risk. It could get stolen or lost, or the government could come ask for it. So it means I have to download a lot of the data onto my own machines. So that's one of the services I use. I use an encrypted cloud service. So instead of using Google Docs, I use something called Spider Oak, which is basically a way to store my files in the cloud, you know, which is sort of remote storage outside of my home, but it's encrypted. It's encrypted when it leaves my machine, and they can't unlock it, so they can't see my data. Only I can unlock it with my encryption open, you know, tools, which is essentially my password. And so that's something else I pay for, but I pay, you know, that's like $200 a year for something. But yeah, I feel like it's my data. It's worth it.
How much does all of this cost you a year?
Well, unfortunately, when I added up how much I had spent on privacy protection, I was a little bit shocked. I had spent almost $2,500.
Wow.
Yeah, in 1 year. And, you know, part of that was two of my two biggest expenses were a burner phone, so a phone that is not in my own name. Mm. It's a prepaid disposable phone. But that's a monthly expense of, you know, $40. And then I also have a MiFi hotspot so that I don't have to rely on public Wi-Fi. I use a MiFi service, which is also $35 a month. So between those two, I had a lot of recurring expenses.
Why is this so important for you? Why have you gone to such great lengths to try to maintain some semblance of privacy?
Well, I would say I mostly started it as an experiment to see whether the premise that we could protect our privacy was actually true. Right? Did we have any choices? And so I started it that way. But what's interesting is it's become basically my way of life. I haven't reverted that much to my old life because I realized that, you know, it was hard to set it up, but I realized that I really appreciate having control of my data and sort of knowing where it's at. And particularly as a journalist, I like to be able to tell my sources, you know, look, I can try to keep our communications confidential because I take all these measures. And that's sort of a competitive advantage for me as a journalist to be able to say, look, I'm the journalist who's going to try to keep your information safe.
Hmm. Well, and I also know that a lot of people lie about maybe their date of birth or their interests or their political affiliation to try to screw up the information that they're sent, especially on sites like Facebook. And you make an interesting point saying that the greatest long-term danger is that we start to internalize the surveillance and censor our words and thoughts until we lose the very freedom that makes us unique individuals. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So essentially, you know, I started to feel that in the end, this surveillance wasn't just a problem for me as an individual or as a journalist, but actually that it was really a problem for democracy, that we have the right to political dissent, to freedom of speech, freedom of association. And these are things that we take really seriously. They're in the Bill of Rights, and we fight for them. And we sort of haven't quite woken up to the fact that constant surveillance of our actions, of everything that we write and everything we say, being stored in some database forever for some purpose that we don't even know now what it'll be used for, is going to chill our free speech and is already chilling mine. You know, the more aware I've become of surveillance, the less willing I am to write anything in any email that's not encrypted. And so I already am sort of feeling like I don't want to say anything because it's going to be stored. And I don't want my kids to grow up in that world. I want them to have the freedom to make mistakes and not have it documented and stored forever and analyzed.
Mm-hmm. Julia Angwin is author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. She is an award-winning investigative journalist at ProPublica, the independent news organization. And if you have any questions for Julia about her journey to try to remain private, and the services that she uses, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And after all of the Snowden revelations, what does privacy mean to you today, and what services do you use? Or maybe you've given something up because of concerns about privacy. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Lee who says, do you think that whistleblowers should be concerned about information gathering? And if so, do you have any examples?
Well, obviously whistleblowers should be concerned about information gathering. We have a whistleblower in jail right now, Chelsea Manning, who, you know, was upset at what she saw happening and sent out information to journalists to reveal things, and now she's in jail. And she, you know, tried to use actually very sophisticated encryption techniques, but in the end, it was actually another hacker who revealed her identity to the federal government. So even if you try to use all this secure encryption, if you tell somebody and they tell somebody else, then you still haven't been completely secret. And we have Edward Snowden, right? He considers himself a whistleblower, and he felt that there was no route for him internally. And now he's living in another nation because he's worried. And he, you know, it's interesting that he revealed himself. He felt that there was no way in this world of ubiquitous surveillance that he would be able to keep his identity secret. I mean, the idea that, you know, no one knew who Deep Throat was, the source for, you know, the Watergate revelations, for until he died, right, which was, I don't know, maybe 30 years, was longer maybe, is not even possible now, right? It wouldn't be possible for me to make that kind of promise to a source, because there would be data. There would be a call between us. There would be an email trail.
Right. Yeah, I sometimes think about the Weather Underground and how they were able to evade the FBI for so long, and that wasn't that long ago. I mean, there's no possible way you could do that today.
Yeah, I feel like it wouldn't be possible. Although, of course, we do have the missing plane, right?
No.
So there's still some hope.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Lee. Mike writes, DuckDuckGo is great, but are you still being tracked by your browser? Are there browsers that are more privacy friendly?
Yes, that is a very good point. So, yes, the browsers also have a lot of information about you. I am constantly trying to find sort of the optimal browser setup to use. I basically use, most of the time, I use Firefox or Chrome with something called HTTPS Everywhere, which encrypts your connections to the Internet. And that's actually important. No matter who you are, you should use that, because if somebody else at a coffee shop is using the same Wi-Fi as you and you're not using that, your communications could be intercepted. And then I use something to block ad tracking, you know, all the different invisible tracking technologies that are out there. And I use Disconnect or Ghostery. There's a new one I'm trying out called Privacy Badger. And I'm always kind of experimenting with these different setups to see which is the best. And in the end, I feel like I most likely am probably 80 to 90% successful in any one of my setups, because there's always going to be something that gets through.
All right. Thanks for the email. Let's go to Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Rose, for another important, interesting program.
Thank you.
I have a question. I hope it's on topic. My question is this. I personally try to keep my life fairly low-tech, but I find that things I do require me to have certain things going on. For example, at my work, it's assumed that I have email, and if I don't, then there's no way for them to get in touch with me, and there's just the assumption that I've got that. Or if I want to find out about certain services or performing groups, they just assume that everyone has Facebook and so on. So I wonder if that's relevant.
That's an interesting point. What are your thoughts on that, Julia?
Well, I have found that that's difficult. You know, it's hard for me. Like, my family gets really annoyed. You know, why aren't you on Facebook, right? We just want to post the pictures there instead of having to email them to you. And there's social pressure to join some of these things. And I do use email, and, you know, but I don't use always the ones that my company prescribes. But luckily, you know, in my business, they're fine with emailing me on whatever email account I ask them to use. But I think that that is a problem, right? I don't think that it's going to be possible to avoid using all these tools, which is why I don't really want to, I'm not advocating for getting rid of these tools. What I'm advocating for is making sure that they meet some sort of safety standard, right? When we get into a car and drive it, it's a dangerous object, but it also has huge benefits. And we know it's met certain safety standards, right? And we just don't actually have that with our data. So there's no law that says Google can't do whatever it wants with your data. And in fact, Google itself changes its privacy policy. So whatever promise it made to you when you signed up, it could change it. Hmm. And it does all the time, regularly changes it, right? And so what I'm saying is, I want to use these tools. I would love to be able to share on Facebook with my family. It would be much more convenient. But the truth is, there's just no assurances for me right now about using these tools.
What do you think of Gmail? Because I find that so many people are now using Gmail.
Yeah, look, I like Gmail. It's a good service. And if they weren't reading my email, I would be perfectly happy to use it. In fact, I haven't completely gotten off of it because I use this other RiseUp collective, but I'm sort of nervous. You know, they're so small, like what if it goes down? So I have my Gmail as my backup because I kind of know they're not going to go down. And so I wish Gmail would just sell me a privacy protecting service. I would pay for it, right? I'm paying RiseUp $100, $200 a year. So why not pay Google?
Tell us more about RiseUp. We got a caller who couldn't stand the line who wanted to know more about it.
Oh, so RiseUp.net is basically, they're a collective in Seattle that wanted to have sort of the best encrypted email system for use by activists. They were worried that, you know, activists who express politically subversive views are going to be surveilled by the government, and they wanted to provide a safe space for activists. So the thing is, it's hard to join it. You know, I had to get an invite from an existing member to join, and then you actually have to agree to their mission statement, which is slightly difficult for everyone to agree to. You have to agree to be against capitalist oppression, gender oppression, I think class oppression. You know, I decided I was against all those things, but it was hard because at the time I was working for the Wall Street Journal, whose tagline was Adventures in Capitalism.
That is, I was going to say, sign me up, but that's hilarious. you had to agree to that while working at the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, it was definitely like I had to walk myself through it, you know.
And so did anything ever come of this?
Well, no. Luckily, I've left Wall Street Journal, so I'm no longer affiliated with the, you know, capitalism. I'm at a nonprofit now, ProPublica. It's a nonprofit investigative journalism. So I feel like maybe I'm more aligned. But I do actually have these moments where I'm like, I'm going to get kicked out of RiseUp. You know, I'm like not really an activist. So.
No longer getting paid from Rupert Murdoch, right?
Yeah. So I mean, hopefully that gives me points in their eyes.
Well, thanks again for the email. Let's go to Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I like your show very much, and I'm glad that you're doing your work.
Thank you.
I'm an attorney, and my interest would be if somebody was going to use all the information that you're talking about that's being collected to prosecute me, let's say, for being an accessory to a terrorist group of some sort. Do you know anybody who so far has been successful in raising a Fourth Amendment, you know, impermissible search or, you know, I know you're not an attorney, but I just wondered.
Yeah, that's great.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. Julia, do you
well,
have any cases like
there
that?
There are a lot of cases where people try to raise Fourth Amendment claims against the data that is used against them from surveillance. However, in many, many cases, the data is never presented. So the way surveillance is often used by the government is to, before they've even established probable cause, right? And then they go to get a warrant to search for the information, and then they go to you and present you with a warrant and get what they need, take your computer or whatever, and that's what they present in court. And you don't often get a chance to see or challenge the surveillance that led up to that search warrant. And so there are people who have fought for that right, and there's actually a really amazing situation going on right now, which is that the Department of Justice has said, you know, the warrantless surveillance that was being done under the Bush administration, right, that was before 2008, basically, from 9/11 till 2008, there was all this warrantless surveillance, and the story was broken by the New York Times. And So now they're going back and reopening some of those cases because they realize they need to actually provide some of the defendants with the fact that they were surveilled without a warrant and allow them to challenge that. But there's only been, I think, one or two cases reopened.
Well, we did a show about privacy, I don't know, 6 months ago, and someone from the ACLU said that the fast track information, for example, we have to use fast track here to go over the Golden Gate Bridge. There's no longer toll takers, and so we do not have an option to pay cash anymore. And so this stuff is all recorded. And the ACLU attorney said that there have been cases where that information has been subpoenaed in divorce proceedings where a spouse is accusing the other spouse of cheating, saying, you know, he went over the bridge a bunch of times, which proves that he's cheating. And that's what, when I thought about the iPhone keeping all of the tracking information, that came up for me because Apple says the data is kept solely on the device and will not be sent to Apple without your consent. But what if the information gets subpoenaed?
Right, exactly. Now, if it's on your device and they don't have it, then the subpoena would have to go to you.
But could it be sent to Apple?
Right, and that's the problem. So last time, I mean, we actually went through this with Apple before, where they 2 years ago, they somebody found that there was a file on an iPhone, basically, that was storing your location data. And Apple basically said, oh, sorry about that, but at least it's not being transmitted. But then it sort of turned out that maybe it was being transmitted every once in a while, and so they took it off. And that's the problem, is that there's often these cases where Apple says, right now, by the way, this frequent locations that you and I just found on our iPhones is just stored on our phone. But we don't have a way to tell if it's really being sent. And that's one of the things about the phone. You can't see the data that's flowing between your phone and Apple.
Hmm.
And you can't audit it. And there's no software I can put on my phone that will show me that data.
Can you think of other examples where this information might be used? I mean, I was thinking, like, if they suspect you of drug trafficking, for example, they could try to subpoena this information. Can you think of other examples?
Well, location information, by the way, I just want to point out, is subpoenaed all the time from your cell phone carrier. So the government gets it all the time. They do things like cell tower dumps where they want to see everyone who is near a certain cell tower at a certain time to find suspects for a crime.
Hmm.
And they'll just get, they'll ask the court to approve a subpoena or a warrant depending on the situation. And they get a huge dump of people who are there. Or they'll get a bunch of numbers that they want to track and then they want to see who's near those numbers, right? So this is happening as a routine law enforcement technique, basically. Cell phone location information is something that the government desperately wants. It makes their job so much easier if you could know where everybody is in real time. In fact, that was one of the most shocking NSA programs revealed, with GCHQ and NSA surveilling the cell phone locations, I think, of everybody in Europe.
Right. I also wanted to ask you about Heartbleed. Last month, there was a security bug discovered called Heartbleed that would allow hackers to get a hold of people's private passwords. So people were encouraged to change their passwords to all of their online accounts. What are your thoughts on this? And do you think that it's a good idea to change passwords on a regular basis?
Well, you know, Heartbleed is complicated because it was a very remote possibility that that bug had been exploited, but that there was no way to know whether it had been, so you kind of have to assume the worst. There are other ways to break your passwords that might have been easier than using the Heartbleed bug because it required an intruder to constantly ping the server over and over again and get random strings of memory back and then eventually hopefully find a username and password. So my feeling was it's kind of a remote risk. So basically I recommended to people change your email password because your email passwords are the ones that can be used to reset all your other accounts. And so, you know, when you do that forgot password link, right, that usually sends an email to your account. And that's how an attacker could get control of that account by doing, if they get your email, then they can do forgot password on any account and get a new password sent to them. So I suggested to people reset the email password because that's a really important password. And the most important thing with passwords is make them really long, 40 characters if you can.
With numbers and caps?
You know, that's not actually as important as the length.
Oh.
And it's okay, yes, definitely numbers and caps if you want. But what I actually do is a method called Diceware, which is 5 dictionary words chosen randomly out of the dictionary.
Huh.
And you string them together, and since they're random dictionary words, I can remember them. And then sometimes I put like an underscore or a number in between the words, but I can remember those passwords, and they're really long.
Wow. Well, we all have our homework for us. Julia, thank you again for joining us. So much great information. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Julia Angwin is author of Dragnet Nation. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Matt Martin, joining Rose here for the last few minutes of the hour. What a great conversation with Julia Angwin. I mean, we need to have this kind of conversation, both for the personal side of things and for the big picture. That's what you get from your call, and it's what we're asking you to support on the second to the last day of our membership campaign here, the Public Radio Party. Your support at 800-525-9917 means a lot right now because we have a challenge. We need 20 people to go to their phones at 800-525-9917, or you can go online at kalw.org. If we get 20 people getting involved. So far this hour, Rose, 5 people have given their support to KALW in this time. If 20 people do it by the top of the hour, it's an additional $865 for local public radio.
800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org. $120. We will send you Julia Angwin's new book, Dragnet Nation. It's full of information on how to protect yourself. I loved what she just said about long passwords. I had no idea. This is the kind of show we need to get this kind of information out. Again, if we can get 20 calls or clicks in the next couple minutes, we'll get an extra $865. This is the second to last day of our membership drive. Help us in getting there. 800-525-9917 or kalw.org.
Our goal is to end by tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. We began this drive with a $375,000 goal. I'm glad to say we are now under $100,000
yes.
to go. Less than $98,000. But that means between now and tomorrow at 6, we've got to push hard and get there. We can do it. 800-525-9917 or kalw.org. You can get Julia Angwin's book. Thank to the person on the line right now.
Thank you.
There is an open line at 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. And we should say on this time around, Matt, we never sell or share any of your personal information. We could, but we don't.
Well, it's because we think the most important relationship this station has is with its listener supporters. So when you sign on with KALW, we don't share your information. We're not into that. We're into building a good relationship with this community. Your support makes that possible.
And it's also opt-in. If you don't want an email, we won't send you emails. 800-525-9917 or kalw.org. Support this no interruption membership drive. I know so many of you appreciate the no interruption drive. 800-525-9917. Join us in celebrating independent public radio. $120, we will send you Julia Angwin's new book. If we can get 20 calls or clicks in the next 2 minutes, we'll get an extra $865. KALW.org.
And everyone who contributes not only helps us toward this challenge, but you'll be invited to our public radio party on June 11th
yes.
in the Mission District. You know Rose and I will be there. You know all the other great KALW folks are going to be there. Folks from Snap Judgment, 99% Invisible, Youth Radio. We will be out there celebrating the community of public radio and the people who support it. 800-525-9917. Rose, we've had gifts today of $50. Some people going at the $120 level, which is the Dragnet Nation book by Julia Angwin, yours for $120 contribution. But we've also had gifts of $500 and $1,000. It's every person doing their part to support KALW that makes it work.
800-525-9917. Get this book by Julia Angwin and share it with people who might not understand how privacy works online. There are very easy steps you can take to maintain your privacy, and that's why we need a show that can spend an hour talking about this information. $120 will send you Julia's new book, 800-525-9917. The most important thing, though, is that you're supporting independent, corporate-free public radio. That is what is so important right now. 20 calls or clicks, we'll get an extra $865. 800-525-9917 or kalw.org.
800-525-9917, 800-525-9917 or kalw.org. So exciting to see that people come through and support the station. 800-525-9917. People like Emo Williams in San Francisco, who said KALW is the real deal in public media. Fred Sharples in San Francisco. Stephanie Ford in Berkeley, who said she loves your call and appreciates Rose's work. You make it possible. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
And I see the phone lines ringing. Thank you so much for your support. 800-525-9917. This is the second to last day of our No Interruption membership drive, where we are celebrating independent public radio. Help us get there. 800-525-9917 or online KALW.org. We are going to end tomorrow at 6 p.m. We've got less than 100,000 to go. Thank you so much for all of your support.
So great.
800-525-9917 or online KALW.org.
And thanks to Kevin Persklove in San Francisco and another generous listener in Oakland who have put forward this challenge, $865, to encourage you to become a member of KALW. 20 folks throw in and say, yeah, I support local public radio, and I understand I got to do my part. If you do that right now, your support will go further, make an even greater impact. 800-525-9917, KALW.org.
It's all about information sharing and spreading the information. That's why we're here, and we know that's why you tune in. Support that kind of independent radio. 800-525-9917.
This is KALW San Francisco, where we are proud to be local, independent, and listener-supported. You make it possible. Be the next person to call or click. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. We're going to the BBC in just a moment. Thanks to everyone who's calling.